The history of Rocky Horror is a history of cinema.
For everything you like about Rocky Horror, there was at least one film that inspired it.
And we're going to review them all on Episode Zero. Everybody, and welcome back to Episode Zero, the Rocky Horror Picture Show podcast, where we don't really talk about the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
And you just ran out of steam right there.
And I'm done. Thank you, everybody. Whitney will take it from here.
Hi, welcome back to the Rocky Horror Picture Show podcast. My name is Whitney Seibold. I'm a film critic, a longtime Rocky Horror aficionado. I've seen the movie numerous times.
We're talking about hundreds.
It is in the hundreds. Maybe close to 1,000, but I stopped counting long ago. Hmm. This comes from the fact that I was working at the movie theater that showed it.
Yes.
So I was on staff every time it showed, so I actually kind of had to watch it even when I wasn't there, like, as an attendant. And this was after a youth of having seen it numerous times. So yeah, I was deep in Rocky Horror for a long, long time. And it was my idea to do this movie.
My name is William Bibbiani. I'm a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs. And yeah, this is the Episode Zero podcast. And on this show, we look at the prehistory of pop culture phenomena. We started off with 20 episodes about the prehistory of Star Wars, the various films that inspired it. And now we're rounding out. We're only got a couple episodes left, but we've been talking about the prehistory of the Rocky Horror Picture Show and the various films that inspired that particular pastiche of all that which came before it. Mm-hmm. And this has been a wild journey. We've been talking about a lot of interesting cinema, some of which better than others. But few, I think we could say, are better than the movie we're talking about this week, because the movie we're talking about on this particular episode of Episode Zero, maybe not top 10, but I think this is one of the best motion pictures ever made.
Cahiers du Cinéma, that once venerable film rag, which was recently bought out by some horrible group, and it kind of just broke apart.
Like all just the critics just year, left, yeah. but they notoriously like absurdly high standards.
Like the highest. Like they were. It's like a Citizen Kane. Sure. Like that. That's their view.
Well, they were the ones who actually vaunted Citizen Kane in the first place in the '50s. Maybe that's not the ideal example.
Bad example. But yeah, when it came to like putting together their like year end lists, they always choose like the most obscure things from all around the world because they were an international paper. And it would always baffle American audiences. Why would you choose that? And sometimes they would throw in like a little bit of a curveball. It's like, oh yes, and Twin Peaks: The Return is the best film of the year. It's a TV series. No, it is a film now. We have said so because we are Cahiers du Cinéma. We can get away with that. Yeah. And then like number 7 on that list. Oh yes, and one of the best films of the decade was The Lone Ranger. It's like, what? No, stop, stop. Now you're just being contrarian. They had really unbelievably high taste, and they listed Citizen Kane as the best film of the decade. This was like about a decade ago when they last did one of these polls.
And number 2.
And number 2 was The Night of the Hunter.
Ben never told you he throwed it in the river, did he?
I can hear you whispering, children, so I know you're down there. I can feel myself getting awful mad.
Here is all the passion and suspense, the heart-pounding warmth of the best-selling novel that gripped millions.
Oh, wake up! Come on, girl!
Superb, unforgettable performances by an extraordinary array of talent.
Figured I was gone, huh?
Run, hide in the staircase. Run quick! Ruby, shit! What do you want?
I want them kids.
I'm giving you to the count of 3 to get out of here, then I'm coming across the kitchen shooting you.
I can't argue the fact that The Night of the Hunter is considered one of the second, is like the second best film of all time, because good golly, is it great.
It's an obscenely good motion picture. This is, this movie has everything. It's dramatic, it's funny, it's frightening, it's wholesome, it's got really, at the time, very contemporary cinematic filmmaking, but it's also incredibly evocative of the silent era.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those interesting sort of midway through the century linchpin films where I feel like it's commenting on everything that came before it while informing everything that came after it. Like, I would put it right up there with, like, Psycho in terms of just how significant a halfway through the history of cinema point it is. Which is weird because Night of the Hunter, when it came out, wasn't particularly well received. It wasn't panned or anything, but it wasn't a huge hit.
Yeah.
It didn't make a lot of money, and the critics were medium. A lot of people appreciated what Charles Laughton was going for, but didn't really outwardly celebrate it. It didn't win a lot of awards, and it just sort of faded a little bit, and then a few decades later, people realized that we've never stopped talking about it, and then it kind of became canonized as one of the great motion pictures. What is The Night of the Hunter?
The Night of the Hunter is a crime drama, and it stars Robert Mitchum as an itinerant, not priest, not minister. He doesn't ever say what church he works for. In fact, the dialogue is, the religion I practice is the one I've worked out between me and God. So he kind of has made up this kind of amalgam of certain, like, puritanical Christian churches. And he travels the countryside preaching and murdering. Especially those things that perfume themselves up and dress all frilly. There's a lot of, like, sexual hysteria, and we learn very quickly that he's a serial killer.
Yeah, he's picked up on a lot of misogyny in the Bible, which, if you've read the Bible, that's not an unreasonable read a lot of the time. No. There's a lot of really negative portrayals of women in the Bible.
In fact, what was that sitcom we talked about on Canceled Too Soon? Living Biblically was the title. Biblically, and it was... the premise was a reporter was going to live by the word of the actual Bible of, I think it was for a year or
something like that. He was like, he gave himself a
finite amount of time. And there was an episode where his wife confronted him about all the misogyny in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, if you're going to live to the letter of this ancient book, are you going to live up to all of the misogynistic stuff as well?
Yeah.
And his gut reaction was like that of defiance. Yes, absolutely. No, wait a minute. That's actually really shitty.
Yeah.
And at the end, he realizes, well, there's actually stuff in the Bible he can't live up to because he has to be a bad person.
Yeah.
Robert Mitchum has picked up on a lot of this. There's a scene right at the beginning where he's at a strip show. I love the way Charles Laughton lights this movie. We'll talk about the lighting in a second, but he's watching a burlesque program, and he's sitting there, and he has his hand in his pocket, and he's holding on to a switchblade in his pocket. And right when, like...
someone might normally be aroused.
Yeah, like, his arousal is an act of violence, and, like, the switchblade knife, like, pokes through his coat, like, right at his crotch level. It's like, okay... And this is right at the beginning of the movie, so it's like, we know exactly where this character stands from.
There's this incredible shot at the beginning of this movie. It opens actually on a star field, like Star Wars, and then Lillian Gish, iconic silent star, in like one last great, amazing role. She's actually preaching to children's, like, floating heads in space, and it just creates this incredibly otherworldly effect where, it just feels like... The world that we're about to watch is a world of parable, and I think that's a really important takeaway. We then cut to some children just playing near a farmhouse, and then they find, like, in, like, the staircase to the cellar, a woman's feet. Not, like, severed, but we're not going to get a gruesome image because it's the 1950s.
The feet of a woman's dead body.
And they're manipulated in such a way where it's like, there's no way she'd be laying like that normally. And then we get a fucking helicopter shot or something, like this really tall, like, pull away. It's just incredibly epic. And then we just cut to Robert Mitchum as Harry Powell.
Talking
to God. God apparently talking back. It's not very encouraging. And Harry Powell is very abruptly, after introducing the character, arrested. not for murder, for stealing a car, and he's given 30 days. At which point, we cut to another group of kids. These are John and Pearl Harper, played by Billy Chapin and Sally Jane Bruce. And their father, Peter Graves, in, I'm sorry.
This is his first film role, I think.
Was this Peter Graves' first film?
Let me double check that.
I think it's his best film.
I think it was definitely early on in his career.
Yeah, Peter Graves. If you don't know Peter Graves, Peter Graves was a big TV star. He was on Mission Impossible. You know,
He played Jim Phelps in the original Mission Impossible.
Yeah. Very, very prolific. Made a lot of B movies. Made some A movies as well. He was Captain Over in Airplane. Probably what a lot of people know him best from.
He's a host of Biography.
Yeah, this was not his first film. He'd already been in Stalag 17, which I apologize. That's also a really good movie.
I apologize. I don't know where I had that in my head.
He was also in It Conquered the World, which is I'm obscenely fond of that stupid movie.
It's quite bad, but it's weirdly watchable.
It's got really good ideas in it, and Beverly Garland's in it, so how bad can it possibly be? But I digress. Anyway, these little kids, their father, played by Peter Graves, zooms up to them in a car and says, "Hey, I got $10,000. I need you to help me hide it." And then he tells the kids to promise him they will never tell where he hid the money.
Not even their mom.
We don't see where the money is now. It might be the sort of thing through cultural osmosis, but we don't know yet.
The cops are on his tail. He has to hide this money right before the cops show up in like 60 seconds.
Yeah. And so he hides the money. He basically throttles his kids. Say, "You can never tell where the money is." And then the cops arrest him right in front of the kids. An incredibly traumatizing moment. And this is something that I've seen this movie so many times, but watching it again for this, after I've been through in the last few years, like on a real journey with my therapy, made me realize just how sensitive this movie is to a children's plight. Like, because those kids have been through a lot. And I think Charles Laughton understands the hell that they're going through.
If you pay attention to the way Charles Laughton directs this, you'll notice that most of the characters, indeed most of the shots, are a little lower than traditional filmmaking. Traditional filmmaking, the director would be from like a standing position or a seated adult.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of the assumption that's
the audience.
There's a lot of lower shots and a lot of lower angles in Night of the Hunter. So it's all told from the kid's perspective.
Yeah. This is a technique that Steven Spielberg would famously use in E.T. the Extraterrestrial. There are very few shots in E.T. that aren't from a child's eye view. And it's incredibly immersive. And it reminds you of a different period in life. Peter Graves is sentenced to die. He killed a guy, apparently, while in the process of robbing a bank. And wouldn't you know it, his cellmate, while he's waiting on death row, is Harry Powell. And Harry Powell finds out about the money, but he doesn't find out where it's hidden. So after Peter Graves dies, and we find out that these children are basically pariahs, they don't go to school anymore. The children in town make fun of them because their dad was executed, which that's fucked up. Harry Powell shows up, claims he was working at the prison, bit of a lie, and starts ingratiating himself into the community. And at first, people are a little suspicious. Then he tells everyone, like, "Oh, no, Peter Graves told me where he hid the money. He said he threw it in the river." And everyone's like, "Oh, that's good. So now we know he isn't after the money." Meanwhile, John and Pearl are like, And their mother, played by the incredible Shelley Winters, is in a position now where everyone in town is basically browbeating her into finding a husband for their kids because their old dad was a sinner. He committed, he stole and killed. You know, he made mistakes. And now these kids need a father figure. And wouldn't you know it, Robert Mitchum just showed up. How convenient. You should marry him. He's probably not a serial killer who's only after the money.
Here's the thing. Robert Mitchum is a supremely creepy actor.
Yes.
I've never seen him play a handsome charmer. Like, he wouldn't take a Clark Gable type role.
No, and nobody, anyone, I think, cast him in one. Like, even if you look at him in something that's a bit more conventional, like, he did a really good movie I like called Heaven Knows Mr. Allison, where he's stranded on a beach in World War II with a nun played by, I think, Deborah Kerr.
I don't know this movie,
Oh, you've never seen it? It's really good. It used to be on all the time when I was a kid. My mom and it was one of my mom's favorites. But the whole thing is, he's stranded on this island, and normally this would be like this really romantic situation, except she's a nun, and he's a brute. He's a big muscle dude who he's got like a heart, but he doesn't really know how to access it. Like, there's something about Robert Mitchum's persona and almost everything you see him in where you just know that even if he's not playing a bad guy, he's probably got away with murder at some point.
Yeah.
He probably beat someone to death with his fists at some point in his life.
Robert Mitchum, by all accounts, was actually kind of a gruff dude as well. Mm-hmm. Not cruel or anything, but yeah, not an easygoing man.
Yep.
I was thrown even more for a loop when I saw his Calypso record at the record store.
I know, it's amazing.
It's, yeah.
It's amazing.
Robert Mitchum put out a Calypso, because he was born in Trinidad. And so he's like, I want to make a record of my home country where I was born. So he made a Calypso record. So bizarre. But yeah, he shows up. Everybody says, hey, Shelley Winters, you should marry Robert Mitchum. And you can see how reluctant she is about that, uh-huh. A, because of her situation.
Yeah, I mean, her husband died. Like, died.
But yeah, like, this is her. She doesn't seem eager about any of this. Yeah. She understands that this is not something that's she wants to do or is really entirely healthy.
But she has come to be convinced, thanks largely to Evelyn Warden, as Icy Spoon.
That's right, Icy.
Who is a character who would be, I think, conventionally and probably accurately described as a, quote, old biddy. She is
a busybody.
Very busybody. Very involved in Shelley Winter's life. Very involved. And you can just tell that, like, she's annoying, she's judgmental, she thinks she knows everything, and anytime she gets her head wrapped around something, she's wrong. Every single time. She's the one who says that Robert Mitchum is going to be the best thing that ever happened to you and your kids. She's a little bit wrong about that. Shelley Winters finally decides to marry him. And that goes really bad. On their wedding night, she shows up wearing like a nightie. Mm. And Robert Mitchum is already like rolled over in bed. And she's just like, hey, you...
Aren't we gonna?
Are we gonna? Did you wanna do marriage, something about this or
marriage thing? You know?
And Robert Mitchum's like, "How dare you?" And he tells her to like look at herself in a mirror, and he shames her, and he says, "A woman's body is designed to bear children. Do you
so
want any more children?"
Painful. It's so painful to watch.
He basically is destroying her in like one scene, and he says, "Because if you don't, unless you want children, we're never having sex." Mm. And she's like, well, "I don't want any more children. Then we're never having sex. Go to bed." And that's going to be their life. And she becomes this person who starts living for her husband because his approval comes at such a high price.
Yeah.
And he starts like using her in like local sermons.
Preacher shows.
He sets up like a tent and he just makes her say like, my sexuality drove my husband to kill just because I wanted perfume. Mm. And I'm like, that's not what he said he did that for. But that's how manipulative Harry Powell can be. That's how manipulative religion can be. That's how religion talks to masculinity can be. That's how manipulative the society that says you have to live this certain way, regardless of whether or not it's a good idea.
And I think it's that evil religious indoctrination, that sort of religious oppression, that connects it to the Rocky Horror Picture Show. But we'll get to that in a second.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a bit.
And we'll mention the knuckle tattoos. That's actually kind of the direct connection to Rocky Horror.
Yeah, the knuckle tattoos. Let's just talk about the knuckle tattoos.
Okay, on his left hand, he has the word hate, H-A-T-E.
One letter per knuckle.
On his hand, and on his other hand, he has L-O-V-E, love and hate. And he gives a sermon in the movie where he talks about how love and hate are the two wrestling impulses in the human heart. So he like puts his fingers together, like laces them together.
They're
and shows
constantly
that they're
in conflict, and eventually good will win, is his philosophy, even though he represents everything evil. This is a speech that is very iconic. You may recall it from the Spike Lee film Do the Right Thing, in which Radio Raheem basically gives the same speech, like, verbatim. It just basically, Spike Lee's like, I don't know, let's just do this scene from Night of the Hunter. I mean, it fits perfectly with Do the Right Thing. It's a beautiful scene, but, like, he's just doing Night of the Hunter. Mm. It's really funny.
And the character of Eddie in the Rocky Horror Picture Show has those same tattoos.
Yeah.
Love and hate. And, you know, the snarky comment from the audience is, I love my bike, but I hate pedestrians. it's really fun. It's stupid and it's fun.
Yeah.
This idea of love and hate becoming this sort of symbol of defiant and also evil, defiance and also evil, is something that kind of leaked into a lot of subculture stuff.
Yeah.
So we're not venerating the Robert Mitchum character, but we are sort of toying with the Wicked imagery.
Well, I think what we're doing is we're taking the Wicked imagery, and we're taking imagery that a lot of movies that we're portraying it as Wicked, like Meatloaf also has. We could have done The Wild One as well for Meatloaf very easily, because that was the movie that it didn't invent leather jackets on motorcycles, of course not. But it did popularize and sexualize it by making it the symbol that Marlon Brando wears throughout the film. But Marlon Brando is not a hero. He's an anti-hero there. He's actually, all of that stuff is kind of a force for wickedness in The Wild One. It's a bit of a judgmental film in some ways. But to appropriate that imagery, that stuff that people tell you is bad, and to make it part of like a punk rock persona... That is something that Rocky Horror does, like, in almost every character who isn't Brad and Janet.
And even Brad and Janet are satirical characters.
Yeah.
So Rocky Horror was really trying to undermine a lot of moralistic hypocrisy and taking a lot of images from things that were expressly moral in the terms of Brad and Janet, or expressly immoral, that is, what as they were dictated by media.
Yeah.
And... throwing it into a party.
Yeah.
Like, throwing a party with it. And that's where we got the knuckle tattoos on Eddie.
Yeah. But back to the Night of the Hunter. We've been talking a bit about this from Shelley Winter's perspective, but really the movie, again, is about John and Pearl. John is a little older than Pearl. Pearl is perfectly willing to take to this new father figure.
Yeah.
She's perfect. Hey, new dad. Cool. Great. Good. I always wondered what happened to the old one. Let's do this. And John is intensely suspicious, especially considering that Robert Mitchum keeps just sort of poking him about where that money is hidden, because John knows where it's actually hidden. Shelley Winters believes that he doesn't know, and when finally she overhears him talking to and abusing, verbally and physically, John and Pearl over where the money is, she finally realizes that she's been had. But it's too late now. They're married. There's nothing she can do. She's in his thrall. And in this incredible scene, this gorgeous shot of their bedroom, and it's so tall and the roof is so angular, it's like they live in a little chapel. And as she is lying in bed, an angelic halo of light over her, as she just says that, well, that's all there is to this, I suppose. And you can see, like, darkness overcome Harry Powell as he sort of recoils in this very silent movie, Dr. Caligari kind of motion, this crooked hand, his own hand coming up upon him. And then he looms over her with the switchblade, and then he kills his wife and throws her in the lake. And in the scene in the movie...
drives her into a lake.
Yeah, and then says, and then tells everyone she left me in the night. She was drinking. She's a bad person. And everyone's like, oh no, poor Harry Powell. Such a good father to those kids.
And in one of the most famous shots of the movie, we get to see the dead Shelley Winters at the bottom of the lake.
And just
there's a pan shot that pans down beneath the water, and we get to see her dead sitting in the driver's seat of the submerged car.
And her nightgown and her hair are floating around her in this very ethereal, dreamlike, ghostly state.
Yeah.
It's just a stunning image.
Images of death and violence can be extremely beautiful, and I think that's what horror teaches you, and that's something that, you know, you want to recoil from the violence, but also they can be presented very beautifully.
Well, I think in a way Charles Laughton is reminding us that Shelley Winters' character is herself a victim here.
Yeah.
And she made some difficult choices, and maybe she was allowed herself to be manipulated, or maybe she just was herself just purely a victim. It's probably true. But when all is said and done, she's also, you know, a ghost. She's also, they have this beautiful biblical imagery around her.
the rest of the film turns into essentially a chase. The kids take to the lamb with the money. He knows they know where it is.
Yeah, turns out it's actually in Pearl's doll. Mm-hmm. And then there's this one incredible moment where John comes home and Pearl has taken all the money out of the doll and she started cutting it into paper dolls.
She doesn't understand that it has value.
Well, she knows that she's done something wrong. It's like, I've been bad, John. I did a bad thing. And John's like, Jesus fucking Christ, put that fucking thing back in the doll. What are you doing? And then Harry comes out and like they've just managed to shove like most of the money back in. And as he walks out, saying this creepy rubber choice, children. As he walks out, the last of the paper dolls like float in the wind, like behind him, like he just misses them. So fucking great. finally, he finds out the money's in the doll, and John and Pearl run, and they take his dad's old skiff, the little raft, and take it downriver. And Harry starts chasing them, and it becomes just a nightmare. Mm. It was already nightmarish, but it becomes like a true, genuine, like just surreal nightmare for a long time.
You know what it reminds me of? Charles Laughton clearly took a lot of his visual cues from old silent movies. Mm-hmm. This is like Citizen Kane, but on a budget. Citizen Kane actually like had a little bit more money to sort of play around as a big studio thing, and you know.
Orson
Welles, a lot of visual effects. Orson Welles is like digging trenches so he can get the camera down low enough. This clearly had like much less money to deal with. Mm-hmm. So what Charles Laughton did is he shot a lot of this in like sort of stark sets. Sometimes there wasn't even a set. He would just cast a light on a back wall. Well,
he wanted it to be impressionistic. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So he's going to like expressionistic. He's going to, films like Caligari, like Nosferatu, all these old silent movies to get a lot of his visual trappings. But when it turns into that chase portion of the movie, it actually reminds me of like the old mill and early Walt Disney cartoons, mm-hmm. because there's a lot of like shadows and silhouettes, and it starts to take on this really kind of artificial, like even more artificial look in the second half.
Well, these children are lost in the wilderness at this point. Yeah, they've lost any sense of connection to anybody. And again, they're little kids. Like John is pretty bright, but he's like, what is he, 10?
He's pretty young. He's 9 or 10.
He's like 9 or 10. And he's put in way too much responsibility to take care of his family, to take care of his sister, to honor his father's dying wishes, which is way too much to ask of anybody, let alone a little kid. And it's really wearing on him. And all he can really do, he has no plan. He has no end game. All he can do is run. And that's it. They're on a raft in the middle of the night, running from essentially the Terminator. Like, there's this scene where they find, like, a barn on the side of the lake or the side of the river, and they decide to, like, stop and, like, try to get some sleep. And that's when they see, as soon as Pearl, like, shuts her eyes, he sees Robert Mitchum in the distance. And he's like, doesn't he sleep? And he's like, no, he's the boogeyman.
Yeah.
He's the absolute worst of humanity, and he has come to get you. And finally, the kids just wash up on shore in front of Lillian Gish. And you would think this would be the point where the movie starts, like, easing up a bit, because Lillian Gish, it turns out, is actually a very good mother figure. She's been raising a lot of kids, children born out of wedlock, orphans in her town, and they very much love her. And maybe she'll protect these kids, but it's actually a lot more to it after this. And it doesn't feel, bless you, it doesn't feel like padded or forced. It feels like we're actually really about to get to something really important here, because the one thing these kids have never had is a reliable parent. A parent who made them feel safe and protected. Even Shelley Winters, who tried. Her solution to the kids are bullying her is just to take the kids out of school. But she's not with them all the day. They're just running around. There is no security that they have ever had. They have never felt secure.
Never been nurtured at all.
Yeah. And all of a sudden, and the relationship between Billy Chapin, or Chapin, I don't know how to pronounce it, and Lillian Gish is so unbelievably heartbreaking, because this is the first time maybe he can trust someone else to take care of him and Pearl. Maybe. Mm-hmm. And it's so touch and go. And Charles Laughton, we haven't really talked a lot about Charles Laughton. Charles Laughton came from a career as an actor. And by 1955... he had been one of the best actors working in cinema for about 20, 25 years. And when I say one of the best actors working in cinema, I mean, like, today, when we, I would look at Charles Laughton in his day the way a lot of people would look at, like, Daniel Day-Lewis or Meryl Streep now. Like, he is consistently unbelievably amazing in pretty much anything he was in.
Yeah. And we've seen him already. If you go over and listen to our Only the Best podcast,
yeah,
we talk about the best picture nominees. He's been in a lot of them.
Yeah.
He was in The Private Life of Henry VIII, mm-hmm, The Barretts of Wimpole Street. He
Ruggles of Red Gap.
Ruggles of Red Gap. He's great in Ruggles of Red Gap, where he plays a butler
hilarious
in the sticks. It's good, like, sort of fish out of water comedy. He was Captain Bly in Mutiny on the Bounty. That's one of his more famous roles.
He was a very, very good Inspector Javert in Les Miserables. Mm.
If you like horror movies, he was The Hunchback in The Hunchback of Notre Dame, mm-hmm, the 39 version.
Yep. He was a pirate in Alfred Hitchcock's very underrated thriller, Jamaica Inn. I recently watched that for the very first time, mm-hmm, and I think that movie's amazing. People talk about it. Mm-hmm. He's so funny in The Canterville Ghost, which is a supernatural comedy, like, very much presages a lot of, like, sort of, like, mm-hmm, supernatural comedies we have today.
The first film I saw him in was Stanley Kubrick's Spartacus.
There you go.
Yeah, where he played a Roman senator, of Roman nobleman of some kind.
He played like Sempronius Gracchus.
Gracchus.
Yeah.
And, yeah, Gracchus was sort of like the wizened, self-aware, but still, like, vaguely corrupt type of character.
Sorry. You got it. I admit it.
No, it's okay. What else did he act?
Oh, I was gonna bring up, because you mentioned horror, and I thought you were gonna bring up Island of Lost Souls.
On Island of Lost,
which he played Dr. Moreau, and he is sublimely creepy in that.
That movie scares me every time. It is
creepy.
So unbelievably scary.
And he was in The Old Dark House, which kicked off our trip through the prehistory of Rocky Horror. So he is coming at the. It's really interesting. A lot of actors, when they take a trip behind the camera and they start to direct, it's only natural that they tend to view a lot of their films as character pieces, because that's where a lot of their background is. And a lot of actors end up making films that feel very, very much like, I don't know, plays or like or character pieces.
Character pieces, a lot of dialogue, a lot of acting scenes, and that's what concerns them.
Yeah, but what's really, really interesting to me are the actors who decide to become a director, and we find out that they're actually really interesting visual stylists. They've really thought about the filmmaking, not just from the perspective of capturing performances, but from all the other angles as well. And Charles Laughton, he had all those other angles as well, but it's easy to get so wrapped up in the incredible sense of style that he crafted here, along with cinematographer Stanley Cortez, who had previously worked on, amongst many other things, The Magnificent Ambersons. And sort of lose the fact that although a lot of the acting is big and arch, it comes from a really intense understanding of characters. And I think this film has a really powerful understanding of trauma. Because what happened to John, Pearl was maybe too young to really fully process it, but what happened to John, seeing his father arrested right in front of him, being forced to make basically a deathbed promise in the middle of playing with his sister, and all of a sudden his whole childhood is shattered, watching his mom marry someone who is obviously manipulating her, being abused by him for the entire duration of that marriage, living in a state of constant panic. That has an effect. And that child gives an incredible acting performance. And I think Charles Laughton understands the nature of the manipulations and abuse that he suffered. And I think he understands the importance of Lillian Gish's character representing positive parenting. She's imperfect. She even talks about how she had her own son and she alienated him. She fucked that up. But she's trying to learn, and she's trying to be a better parent to other kids. And the way that she uses the Bible to teach children, and not to correct them with it either. Like, if she talks about, like, the Moses, she equates the story of Moses being found along the river. John immediately equates that to him and Pearl. And he says, oh, when they found those two babies. And she's like, no, it was, you know what it was too. You know why? Because it really doesn't fucking matter. The point of the story is more important than the details.
Yeah.
It's not about dogma. It's about sensitivity and love. And boy, is she fucking great.
Yeah. What she represents is, if you want to see The Night of the Hunter as a Christian parable, which sure. it can be read as easily.
Totally.
This is Charles Laughton essentially saying, there's a right way and a wrong way to do this.
Yeah.
Dogma, hate, mm-hmm. pressure,
false
rules.
Prophet.
Yeah. And, you know, that's not to be trusted.
Yeah.
A killer can say that. A charismatic murderer. Yeah.
Anyone can pretend just by quoting the Bible.
Yeah.
Living it is different.
Actual compassion, you know, Christian behavior mm-hmm. is perhaps more correct.
Yeah.
That's an argument that's being made here.
Yeah. So what happens is she takes in John and Pearl. They start acclimating. They start, like, becoming mm-hmm. more safe, better off. And then one night, the teenage girl that she has taken in. Ruby? Ruby is a teenage girl, and she has been going out. She said she was taking, I think, sewing lessons, but actually she's been going out with boys. And one night, while she is going out to find boys to give her attention, she's found instead by Harry, who feeds her ice cream, finds out all about where John and Pearl are, and gives her some bullshit about, you know, his misogynistic form of Christianity. And because he's the only person who didn't try to use her that she could tell, she immediately falls in love with him. And it's a very strong reminder. It's really cool that we actually get this reminder late in the movie after we are long since convinced of his unbelievable, unmitigated evil. It's a really potent reminder that his evil works. His manipulations have power over people who need what he's selling. And when Lillian Gish sees Ruby coming home and Ruby says, I've not been taking sewing lessons, I've been going out with men. Lillian Gish has this wonderful bit where she like pets her head and say, you were looking for love and you were looking the only way you knew how. And that's okay. And it's not an exchange for anything, and it doesn't come from a place of hate. Which is what Harry does.
Yeah.
So this all leads to Harry's assault on the house, which today would be a lot more action-packed, I think.
Yeah, but it's basically like throwing Molotov cocktails and stuff. Or, yeah.
But it's basically Lillian Gish, like, on the porch with a shotgun, like, while Harry Powell is, like, looming in the distance, just basically waiting for her to let her guard down. Mm. And she's so great. Lillian Gish, who I don't know how old she was. She looks 80. She looks really frail. And you know she's going to kick Robert Mitchum's ass.
This was one of her last movies, I think.
It had to have been, right?
Yeah, she was pretty old at this point.
She wasn't that bad. No, she wasn't that old, actually. She was only in her 50s.
Oh, okay.
She was born in 1902. For some reason, I thought she was so much older than that. She was born in 1902, so she was...
Lillian Gish was born in the 90s, like 93.
I'm sorry. I was looking at her years active.
Oh.
I apologize. She was born in 1893, so she was in her 60s. She was in her 60s. She lived to age 99. She lived to 1993.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And good for her. Let's see. She closed her career in 1987.
What was her last movie, I wonder?
The Whales of August.
I never saw The Whales of August.
Yeah,
this
co-stars her and Bette Davis.
It's a Lindsay Anderson film, if I recall.
Yeah, Vincent Price was in it too. Holy crap. Wow. How have I not seen that?
I want to see that one.
How have I not seen this damn movie? I want to see this movie.
A lot of the films, like, quote, for grown-ups that were made in the 80s have been sort of swept aside in favor of a lot of other things. But, yeah, that one sounds good. Lillian Gish.
Yeah, it's exciting. Cass,
go Lillian Gish. I'm getting everybody's careers wrong in this episode here.
I was wrong. I thought her career was actually a little shorter than that. But in any case, she's fucking astounding in this. It ends with this beautiful breakdown from John as he finally just gives up on hiding the money. And he just says, I don't care if my dad like told me to hide this. I can't do this anymore. I can't do this anymore. And he just gives up and is allowed to be a kid again. And it's so fucking beautiful. Broke my fucking heart this time now that I really understood so much more about what goes on behind it. It's so fucking good. Ah, I love this movie.
It's really, really, really good.
Oh my God.
We touched upon how it relates to Rocky Horror. And apart from the knuckle tattoos, I did want to just say a few extra words about sort of religious oppression. And how playing with religious imagery is something that both this film and Rocky Horror does. Night of the Hunter is actually incredibly subversive, especially for the mid-50s, in turning a preacher into a serial killer. First of all, there weren't a lot of serial killer movies, at least not in the public eye at the time.
No, it was very uncommon. A lot of them were like Bluebeard stories. That was a very common, and men who would marry women and then kill them. Chaplin did a comedy called Monsieur Verdoux.
Monsieur Verdoux is
which
great.
Is co-written or based on an idea by Marlon, not Marlon Brando, by Orson Welles. Depending on who you talk to, he either wrote it or he had nothing to do with it. Let's see, Joseph Cotten had played a Bluebeard in Shadow of a Doubt.
Yeah, but Honeymoon Killers was later. But
Honeymoon Killers was later. Yeah, but yeah, serial killers were not like part of the common parlance, nor would they be in cinema until probably after Psycho.
After there was a big boom in of serial killer movies post Psycho, and
Peeping Tom was concurrent, but Psycho was the popular one. So.
And then again in the 90s, the post Silence of the Lambs wave.
In the original book, I believe he was actually a preacher, and then they had to like make him not quite a preacher, like a guy pretending to be a preacher. Mm-hmm. They had to change that for the movie. It works.
He was dressed as a preacher.
Yeah.
And he murders people.
They get away
with
it. Yeah.
And I think Charles Laughton was able to get away with it because this is not a lascivious movie. It doesn't relish in the violence. It makes everything very stylized. So I think it was a little bit more, perhaps more palatable. Maybe that's why it wasn't a hit, though. Mm. People weren't ready for this image of priestly serial killer. And it was just either too distasteful or just not something people could jibe with.
Some of the reviews that I read from the era were really like a lot of people were just saying, yeah, Charles Laughton's got an interesting style. He clearly swung for the fences, but it sounded like they only wanted to engage with this film as a potboiler.
Yeah.
And as a result, as a potboiler, it's a little straightforward. The structure is odd. And I don't think they were looking at it as serious social commentary, which it has a huge element of course. And I think as a result, if you're only looking at it from that one angle, it can look a little warped. But if you're looking at it from like two angles simultaneously, you get the depth.
Yeah.
That's what depth of focus is.
Yeah. If you are a young queer person in the mid-50s, and you've probably taken abuse from hypocritical Christians who are treating you badly, or you're at least getting anti-queer messages and you're in the closet, then seeing a vilified preacher must be very cathartic. And indeed, once you get to an expressly queer movie like the Rocky Horror Picture Show, they are essentially just tearing religious iconography to the ground. And this is something we talked about with Scorpio Rising as well, how a lot of Catholic imagery and religious imagery is being used to bolster rather than oppress queer people.
Mm.
You go through the Rocky Horror Picture Show, it is loaded with wedding imagery and Christian imagery, if you know where to look. First of all, it starts with Brad and Janet having this sort of beatific song about getting married. Here's the ring to prove that I'm no joker, in the song Damn It, Janet. You'll notice that they're just leaving a wedding. Mrs. Dern and Mrs. Ralph Hapshad go driving off, and they are so taken by the romantic moment that Brad proposes to Janet.
Mm-hmm.
It's a silly song. It's meant to be a little bit too perky, and Brad and Janet are too perky. And you'll notice during that scene, they're turning the wedding into a funeral while they're singing this song, and they're marching down the aisle where they're wheeling in a casket.
And you'll notice that the priest in that scene is played by Tim Curry.
Tim Curry and also Richard O'Brien and Patricia Quinn and Little Nell are all in that scene.
Yeah, they're playing different characters, which is sort of like
are they hiding out in some way?
Dichotomy.
Later on, that scene is mirrored by the wedding scene between Frank and Rocky.
Yeah.
Where, and he sings about, I'm going to grease you up in 7 days, I'm going to make you a man, he's going to fuck. And it's like rubbing grease on him, and then they walk up the aisle, and what happens at the end, Frank leaps into Rocky's arms in this really sexual sort of way.
Yeah.
So they're using a lot of this traditional religious iconography to show, this is all bullshit.
Yeah.
This is all bullshit. Weddings are kind of bullshit. Christianity is kind of bullshit. And we were given this sort of imagery that it's okay to put these anti-religious images, that is, through the lesson of media from this film from the 1950s. They were doing it as far back as then, 20 years ago.
Yeah, and of course there are precedents even before this, but this is a gigantic one.
There's been anti-religious imagery as long as there's been religious imagery. Yeah. But, you know,
I just want to make it clear, we're not claiming this movie invented that. Just want to make that clear.
Goodness no, this is a tradition thousands of years old.
No, but that was, but by the time Rocky came out, this movie was like less than 20 years old, and terms it was very popular, very big.
Contemporary media imagery that Rocky Horror was directly drawing on. That's what it's taking from The Night of the Hunter to offer the tenuous connection.
Yeah. But in any case, yeah, Night of the Hunter. If you haven't seen it, obviously we've ruined it for you. Sorry.
I don't think we've ruined it.
I think if you were interested, you would have either seen it by now or maybe noticed that we were talking about it. And if you kept listening, you noticed that we were doing the plot. So hopefully you don't mind too much, but in any case, hopefully we've given you the framework to maybe look at the film and maybe appreciate some of its wonders, because this movie is wonderful, and it's super creepy, and it's weirdly funny, and it's really thoughtful and hopeful while being incredibly sad. It really is one of the best. I think it's one of the best motion pictures ever made. Yeah. So
and it's widely available. Yeah. There's a really great Criterion edition of it.
Right now, I believe it's no extra charge on Amazon Prime. If you have an Amazon Prime account, you can just watch it.
It might also be on HBO. Although, curiously enough, it's not on the Criterion channel right now.
I don't think it's on HBO.
It's rotated
either.
Out for a
I don't
second.
Think it's on HBO either. But in any case, it's pretty easy to find. Mm. Please check it out. There was some talk not that long ago that they were going to remake it. And there was this huge outrage. How could they ever remake Night of the Hunter? To which I said, again? They remade this in the 90s. It's what, it was Richard Chamberlain playing Harry Powell? Like, it's been done. Like, nothing sacred. Which I think is kind of the point of the movie. So who really... It's kind of really hypocritical to complain. But I still think the original is incredibly special. It's a shame
Charles Laughton.
It's the same Charles Laughton never directed again. The movie not being a particularly successful film, not getting good reviews, apparently hit him pretty hard, and he just never really felt motivated to try again, which is a damn shame because he was good.
It wasn't a troubled production, but Charles Laughton evidently just wasn't enjoying making it. This is hearsay. This is like things that other people have said about the experience. I know that Robert Mitchum felt this was kind of a silly role. He didn't like a lot of sort of the broader things that the character had to do. He thought he was a little bit too much of like a monster and not menacing in a real sort of way. He especially objected to the monologues. There are scenes like, hey, Lord, I'm going to talk to you. Like, evidently, you can see Robert Mitchum cracking up on camera because he thought those scenes were so funny.
Yeah.
Like, they actually had to use those takes in the final cut of the movie.
It's weird. Piper Laurie, when she made the original Carrie, said she thought it was supposed to be a camp comedy, too. And yet, you watch the movie and she's just fucking terrifying because some people really are larger than life. And so it's easy to believe in those characters because that's where their headspace is.
Charles Laughton made such an impactful movie and made it in such a powerful way and in such a stylized way that even if Robert Mitchum is kind of like snickering to himself, Charles Laughton was able to roll with that and put it into like the fabric of the stylized universe.
Fucking incredible movie. Anyway, that is it for episode zero. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll be back next week with the penultimate episode of Rocky Horror Episode Zero.
Mm-hmm.
Only got two left. And we thought for the second to last episode, we might go somewhere interesting. We thought we might go to, I don't know, like the Valley of the Dolls or something. But instead, we decided to really push ourselves.
And go a little beyond, as it were.
Beyond the Valley of the Dolls.
Can't we get beyond the Valley of the Dolls?
And now the Rangoon version of this joke. No, we're going to go beyond the Valley of the Dolls. It is another Russ Meyer joint. It's always a pleasure to take a trip down to that guy's filmography because he's weird and wonderful.
And this is one of his biggest, weirdest, loudest movies.
Yep, and I'm going to see if I can convince the inimitable, impeccable, and ingenious M. Lapis da Silva to join us once again for Beyond the Valley of the Dolls.
Oh, do you know her?
Well, okay.
Fun fact, while we're recording this, she's making soap elsewhere in the apartment. So we'll get her back and we'll talk about Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, which is a cult classic that I mean, if we
it's
weren't...
It's got everything.
If we weren't talking about the Rocky Horror Picture Show still, like, if this was... If Rocky Horror Picture Show wasn't the midnight movie, it would probably be Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. Mm-hmm. Like, if there was room to do more than one midnight movie per theater, we would be having concurrent showings of Beyond the Valley of the Dolls constantly. Because it's... If you love Rocky Horror and you've never seen it, like, holy crap, you're gonna love it. It's like, what the fuckery is just everywhere, strewn about like silly string. It's fantastic.
It should be called What the Fuckery, the movie.
Yeah. How did they turn that book into a movie? Anyway, that is it for episode zero, though. So thank you, everybody, for listening. We want to give a very special thank you to all of our patrons over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, without whom this show and none of our other shows could exist. So thank you for everything. You mean the world to us. If you can't afford to be a patron, we totally get it. If you can, you get a lot of exclusive shows. We do commentary tracks, shows about Star Trek, Batman, the Academy Awards, Disney, a lot. We try to make sure there's a lot of bang for your buck over there. So that's patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. But if you can't afford that, please leave us a review. Star rating, couple of sentences, whatever you can make the time for. That really helps more than you could really possibly know. Like, it really helps push us up the algorithm and makes people find the show. We're also on Twitter. We are at Critic Acclaim. I am at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
And, of course, if you like soap...
Some is being made within earshot.
Like, right now, actually, we have a lot of fancy handmade soaps, mostly designed and created by M. Lapis da Silva, who is behind me.
Hi.
And they're over on our Etsy store. Look for Etsy and search for Salt Cat Soap, all one word. You can also follow Salt Cat Soap, all one word, at on Twitter and Instagram. We have a lot of really, really gorgeous designs currently available now, including really fancy Father's Day gift sets. It's not too soon. I want to get that off the to-do list right now. But we also debut a lot of new designs and things on the first Saturday of the month. We don't just have soaps. We also have stickers and lotions and bath salts and a lot of other cool, a lot of cool products. So please check it out. Thank you for everyone who already has. You're great. And that's it. Is that it?
Well, we do have to shiver in something.
Oh, yeah, we have to shiver. And wait a minute, you have another podcast.
Oh, that's right. I do have another podcast. I just started. In fact, I recorded just the second episode today, and it should be going live by the time you hear this. Over on The Screen's Margins, a brand new podcasting network founded by the venerable B. Peterson, they and I are talking about Ovid. The podcast is called All About Ovid, spelled with all O's. Isn't that fun?
Adorbs.
Ovid is the streaming service for people who think that the Criterion Collection is way too mainstream, man.
Yeah.
It's all of those films that showed in museums in your town, or like we're only showing for one day at the one art house you have in town.
If you ever wanted to see a five-hour film from a country you've only vaguely heard of.
Well, I think you've heard of the country of the Philippines. The latest episode, however, we B and I talk about Lav Diaz's film From What Is Before, which is 5 hours and 38 minutes in length. That sort of thing,
yeah,
is what's available on Ovid. Things that you know, from all over the world, really, really challenging, interesting, complex art.
Films that are not made by committee and don't fit into tidy little boxes, which really you'd think that people would be a bit more excited about, considering how much of what we consume is really tidy.
Yeah. So B decided Ovid is here. We have access to it. Why don't we just watch what we want on Ovid and talk about it on a regular basis? Mm-hmm. So we've done that now for two whole episodes, and we're going to continue doing it for as long as we're interested. As long as there's interesting stuff on Ovid, which will be always.
Well, yes. Until it gets sucked up by Roku.
No, that was Quibi.
Well, you never know. Maybe Roku is just going to gradually just like turn into the singularity that pulls in all the smaller streaming services and then becomes the biggest streaming service as a result.
I would love some weird cinematic space where Quibi and Ovid are like right next to each other.
Or Murder House Flip.
Yeah, I'm going to watch, Murder House Flip followed by a Lav Diaz film. That's going to be great.
Now that's cinema. That's the name of our new podcast. That's no, it's not. Thank you, everybody, once again. Check out All About Ovid. It is on the Screen's Margins podcast feed. Search for that wherever you find fine podcasts. And, of course, you can also find them on Twitter and such. That's it from us. I see you quiver with anticipation.
That shiver.
I see you shiver with anticipation. patient. What? What do you want from me? It's not like I host a podcast about the Rocky Horror Picture Show.